Recently, I've been responding to claims that Hinduism is stupid and irrational, and one of the arguments I have presented is that India's ancient civilization was highly advanced in many ways. Still, the members of that civilization subscribe to largely the same worldview that we could say modern Hindus do in terms of religious belief or understanding, which suggests that such great advancements in or such great knowledge in various fields of science and mathematics and musical theory and economic planning and so on, linguistics, so many fields, when these were not stupid people. These were not ignorant barbarians as the British in particular wished to paint the Indians. Now, my particular role as a servant of His Divine Grace Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, who is the founder of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, which is the modern organizational manifestation of the Brahma Madhva Gaudiya Vaishnava Sampradaya, which has its roots in great antiquity. So my role as a servant in this tradition is to represent that tradition. And the crux of that tradition is the understanding that everything in this world is temporary. We are eternal spiritual beings. We are eternal servants of Krishna, who is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So basically, I am what would, from a secular or sociological position, I am a religious preacher, although I prefer to consider myself as a transmitter of the timeless truths of Vedic wisdom. This Vedic wisdom teaches us, that everything in this world is temporary. We don't need Vedic wisdom to understand that, but it does help us to put it into focus, because most people, they don't live their lives thinking that everything in this world is temporary and what is the eternal beyond it. So, talking about India's achievements in the past or even at present really isn't my job or what I'm supposed to be doing. But because there are attacks on the very basis, the very foundation of what I have to present, I have to present the ultimate truth. The ultimate truth as revealed in the Vedic wisdom. And there are those who want to bash that Vedic wisdom as being irrational, stupid. So then it becomes incumbent to examine what is the actual position. It's not the essence of what I am supposed to deliver to analyze the antecedents of present-day Hinduism. But just like it may not be my role in life to find out what is the best umbrella. If we're expecting a heavy monsoon season ahead, and I need to get an umbrella. I may need to find out what is the best suited for my purposes. So I may spend some time discussing that. Of course, I wouldn't spend a lot of time discussing what's the best umbrella, but yeah, if I have to get a new laptop, it happens time to time, every few years, then I may have some discussion on it. Even though I'm not expert on it, I have some knowledge of it, and it is useful for the service that I have to perform. So the real service I have to perform is to Shravan Manan Nididhyasanam, states the Upanishad, to myself hear and absorb Vedic knowledge, to contemplate on that, to internalize it, and also to, as ordered by my guru, to share that with others. So that's really what I have to do. And all I've said up to now is an introduction to speaking on various facets of the greatness of Indian civilization previously. There was actually a book, The Wonder That Was India, written by A.L. Basham. His middle name, his first name, I don't remember, Llewellyn Clwellyn, his Welsh name was the middle name, and Basham, he was the professor of South Asian studies at National Australian University in Canberra. So he wrote a book which is still highly respected in the academic fields, and there have been many, many books showing what a tremendous civilization India had in the past. And I'm going to speak on that now, based on a posting in comment on this series of talks, Stupid Irrational Hinduism, (?), comments given by Vishnu Jandas, a dear disciple of mine. I believe he's still in New Jersey. This is the last I heard of him. No reason to suppose he's no longer in New Jersey. A posting based on various statements which he had picked up from the internet, and I don't know if it's his own exposition of that, but I'll speak on it. I'm not going to speak exactly what he says. I'll add some comments here and there, and I may leave some of the things out also. But it is interesting, and it can help to bolster the faith of persons who constantly hear how their religion is stupid, or it could give people who constantly get this kind of propaganda, it could give them another perspective. Of course, they're not the kind of people who listen to this talk. Anyway, let's get on with it. It has been said that a modern newspaper contains more knowledge of the world than most people in the 18th century possessed. Yeah, how many people in the 18th century would know about Canberra? Well, no one. There was no Canberra. The land was there. But it wasn't expected that people in general knew what was going on beyond their valley or their hamlet, not even aristocrats. I'm not sure about that, aristocrats, because definitely just like the King of England would have to have some knowledge, or at least his courtiers, the aristocrats, they would have to have some knowledge of what is Yorkshire, what is Lancashire, what is Northumberland at the border with Scotland, because the border with Scotland was always a sensitive point, and then what is Lincolnshire, and they'd have to know all these things. What is Devon, what is Cornwall, what is Wales? They'd have to have some knowledge. and people did travel. So aristocrats, they may have some more knowledge, but education was for the few. Formal education was largely for clerics, that in this sense, cleric means religious person. And these persons, the term cleric, that also suggests they became the clerks, or the, because you need people to keep records. There are written documents, legal documents. The Magna Carta was a written document. Probably most people in the 18th century in England hadn't heard of the Magna Carta. The point is, even to read a newspaper, which is also a newspaper, is becoming, the very term newspaper is becoming anachronistic, as newspapers, it's funny how the English language develops, it's still called a newspaper, but it's mostly on the internet now. Mostly people read on the internet. So to even read, especially the more highbrow kind of newspapers, you're expected to have a lot of background knowledge. Although the average person in the street, if you go in America and ask the average person on the street, well, I know this from when I was in the 1980s, I spent time on and off in Thailand. And mostly our American devotees, when I said, oh, I'm in Thailand, they said, or Taiwan, they hadn't heard of Thailand, which is, it's quite a big country. At the time, even at the time, it must have been about 60 million population, quite a large country, not a very important country in terms of world geopolitics, although it had more importance during the time of the Vietnam War. But most people, oh, Taiwan. They may have heard of Taiwan because of the perennial tension between Taiwan and Red China, as it used to be known. But if you mention other neighboring countries to China, like Laos, even at the present day, even Iraq, hardly anyone in America had even heard that Iraq existed, such a country existed, before George W. Bush, I believe it was, decided that it was time to invade the country for the sake of humanitarianism and democracy and human rights and all that kind of thing. Even though most people probably had a bit of Iraq in their cars to run the car along, which was maybe why, just one of the reasons why the great politicians of America, along with their humanitarianism, decided it was time to invade Iraq. What to speak of Kuwait? So mostly they haven't heard of these places. If you ask where is, I don't know, Costa Rica, it's just a relatively short distance from the United States. Dominican Republic, where is it? Where is it? Who knows? Who knows? Put your hands up if you know. You can look it up on the internet. So most people, they don't have an encyclopedic knowledge, but to read a newspaper, you do need to be somewhat informed. But people living in a village in merry old England in the 18th century, they didn't know so much. They didn't need to. To live, to eat, to sleep, to gossip with the local people, to go to the local pub and drink some ale. They didn't need to know very much at all. So they didn't. What was the purpose of educating? Education came more as society became more complex. It became necessary with the onset of the Industrial Revolution, and you have to have people who know how to count and do basic arithmetic. Of course, at least merchants would know how to do that in 18th century England also. But it became necessary, as you want to sell things to, as the consumer society developed, you want to sell all kinds of gadgets to people, and then they have to be informed. And then as there's mass mobility and telecommunications, society changed a lot. And even to function in present day society requires that you have to be incarcerated in a children's prison, which is called a school, and have all kinds of things taught to you so you can be a good citizen. You need to know quite a lot of things. So, if people didn't know what was going on a few villages away, or even if a few villages away, if they even existed, they didn't need to know. If most people didn't know, what would they know of India? And even until recently, maybe still going on in Papua and New Guinea, in Papua, which you may have heard of. It's vaguely called Southeast Asia, Oceania area. So the country is highly mountainous with lots of deep valleys, steep valleys, and jungles. And you find so many people there generally haven't been very civilized. Sorry to say that. Probably it's not politically correct to say that. And they've lived in different tribes. And there may be a tribe on one side of a mountain, another on the other side of the mountain. They have no interaction for generations. Their language is completely different. They don't need to contact each other. And physically, it's very difficult to do so, because there are steep mountains and with thick wooding, and so they didn't know very much. So people didn't, the contention is that in the West, people were largely unaware of what's going on in India. This is what has been sent to me, but it may need more investigation. There was the what was his name? The Merchant of Venice. Oh, I'm just... Marco Polo. Marco Polo. He was somewhat sensational when he went to China, and he came back and told so many stories which people didn't believe, many of them. So Marco Polo described a highly developed civilization which people previously in the West hadn't been aware of, and they became very interested in it, and they became very interested in India when they learned it was such a fabulous place. Fabulously wealthy. Generally, even up to the present day, it's generally presented in the Western world that real civilization is in the West. And the beginning of civilization is with the ancient Greeks, just starting a few hundred years before the advent of Christ. And it's still a very commonly stated among intellectuals in the West that modern Western civilization is the most advanced in the history of man. They actually believe that. Maybe it's technologically advanced in some ways, but even though they talk about human rights and all this kind of thing, it's a slaughterhouse civilization. America has come up, and Britain has come up by... apart from slaughtering animals, from slaughtering humans also, and slaughtering their cultures. Anyway, I don't want to get too much into a political stance, but actually this is all political, isn't it? It's all what you could call soft politics or misleading people. Machiavelli, he was right. People say Machiavelli was bad, but largely his strategies are the ones that are used by the leaders of the world up to the present day, although they wouldn't admit it. Anyway, there were fabulously developed civilizations in India and China, while in Europe they were going through what they call the Dark Ages, although they don't want to call it the Dark Ages anymore. They don't admit that they were practically living like savages, by even by their own definition. Anyway, yeah, there were so many fabulous cities, wealthy cities in India and China, whereas in the West, there was Rome, Constantinople, even Russia. They're very proud of their, what is it, 1,000 years history? Is this just 1,000 years? What's that? It started in Kiev, not even in Russia. Well, Kiev is in the Ukraine, for those of you who don't know. Anyway, talking about the 18th century, that is around the time when Western intellectuals started to become familiar with Indian culture and civilization and literature and philosophic thought. And mostly they marveled at it. Of course, they came in contact with it in translations. And even though the translations were largely botched jobs, which is not surprising if you consider that Sanskrit is a very different language. Well, even it's the same pattern as German in many ways, not French, definitely not English. But it's highly sophisticated, and there's so many cultural implications, as in every language, in the words, and so many things about the culture which the translators didn't know. But still enough came through that so many intellectuals marveled. Voltaire, you may have heard. Swiss, French, one of the greatest, is mentioned as a philosopher, but like some of the philosophers, he was not exactly a philosopher. Anyway, he stated, everything has flowed down to us from the Ganges. This is how the translation comes. Actually, the word is Ganga, but in English it has become Ganges. And how it's pronounced in the French that Voltaire spoke, I don't know. But this is how this quote is presented in English. Everything has flowed down to us from the Ganges. So many things. So much knowledge, even in Greece, what they say, ancient Greece. It's not proven, but it seems highly likely that much of what Greece had came from India. What they call Arabic numerals were actually from the Vedic tradition. They say it was a great invention of the Hindus, the decimal system, having a zero and a decimal point. Although it's not exactly if we understand the Vedic teachings, it's not exactly an invention. It's just been there forever. Anyway, that's what Voltaire said, among other things. Now, and there's a statement here. Christian missionary and colonial spirit also tended to downplay the achievements and histories of colonized lands as a way to justify, quote-unquote, civilizing and converting them. This is euphemistic language. Downplay? Downplay the achievements and histories of colonized lands. They didn't downplay them. They grossly misrepresented them. They lied about them. They covered up anything good about them. invented bad things about them, actual bad things they magnified, they misinterpreted. They had this theory that only we, the British, are civilized. Maybe the Germans a little bit, not the French, definitely not the Italians. Only we, the British, are civilized. But in general, European man is the best, and of course the British are the best, and among the British, the English are better than the Welsh and the Scots and the Irish. So that was the general feeling. And then you go to India, and these people, they don't even have white skin. Something, they can't be civilized. The fact that faced the British and the Dutch and the French and the Portuguese when they came to India is that they were face to face with the remnants of a great civilization, which even suffering under foreign rule, Muslim rule for centuries, had not lost its spirit, had not been subjugated in its spirit. When they came face to face with that, some of them delighted in it. Some of that was the general tendency, but then it was found politically inexpedient to do so. And so all Indians, by decree from Westminster, became savages. Not officially. Well, almost officially, because it was in the Parliament, Lord Macaulay, saying that. Anyway, it's a big history. I don't know it all. Nor is it that much important in terms of spiritual understanding, but it is important because India has been seriously misrepresented up to the present day. It's going on, and this goes on. That the principal reason ancient Sanskrit was not considered the root of Indo-European languages. Voltaire says everything has come down to us from the Ganges because the first students of Sanskrit from the West start to realize, hey, this is the root of all the European languages. But then, whoa, wait a minute, that can't be right. So what was required was to concoct the Proto-Indo-European language to argue that the similarities of languages in all European languages, the similarities that are there with Sanskrit, not because they descended from Sanskrit, but rather that Sanskrit and all the European languages descended from a proto-Indo-European language, of which there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever except in the minds of linguists who dream it up. It's written here, Sanskrit is the Latin of classical Vedic or Hindu culture. Not really. It's much more than that. Because Latin itself is a derived language, whereas Sanskrit is an eternal language. And it's perfect. Sanskrit, the very word Sanskrit means perfectly. It's a perfect language. What I'm saying, you may contest, but you have to study, see for yourself. Then there was this whole thing about Aryan invasion theory that actually, Aryan invasion theory, another something made up politically to divide the Indians and to try to say that Indians are not indigenous people. There's a term for the tribal people in India, which is used in India, called Adivasi, which means original resident, with the idea that they were there, and then we came in later. This is all propaganda, that we came from Caucasia, from the Central Asia. But this is nonsense, because from the Vedic description, we understand that people, just like you have up to the present day, you have Gotras, descended from rishis, Kashyap Gotra, Gautam Gotra. These are going on from time immemorial, practically. The idea there was an Aryan invasion was made up by the British for political reasons. The German states, on the other hand, there was no united Germany at that time. There were various German states, Schleswig and Holstein and so many. Prussia was quite big and so many. Bavaria, they're still there, the states, but now it's one unified country. The German states, they had no political agenda in India, so they were open to recognize the greatness of Vedic culture and thought. Beethoven, one of the most famous Germans in history, the most famous was an Austrian, infamous. But Beethoven was inspired by the Upanishad. Holst, not nearly as famous as Beethoven. Schopenhauer, one of the great German philosophers, was openly, openly, everything he said came from the Upanishads. And other names are given here. Dusan, Hegel, Schelling, Fichte. Fichte's not so big, but he's a run-on from Kant. Mention other names, Herder, Goethe, and then the German Romanticists, Heinrich, Heine, Schlegel, that's misspelled. More recently, one of the many influential books of the hippie generation, although it was written some, 35, 40 years before the hippie generation arose, was Hermann Hesse's Siddhartha, based on the life of, based on Buddha and Buddhism, and clearly, I mean, undisguisedly. So yeah, these are just some major, Hermann Hesse, German. So these are just some major figures in the history of Western intellectual thought who have been very much influenced and openly acknowledged their being influenced by Vedic thought. Definitely the American transcendentalists, among whom Thoreau, Emerson, most famous, Walt Whitman, very famous. Mark Twain, one of the most famous American authors of yesteryear, now is not allowed. He's been banned in many American libraries for his statements, which are now no longer considered proper. But anyway, he was very influential. He wrote. Very influential means that generations of Americans grew up reading his books. India, he wrote. India is the cradle of the human race, the birthplace of human speech, the mother of history, the grandmother of legend, and the great-grandmother of tradition. Our most valuable and most instructive materials in the history of man are treasured up in India only. And then there's a whole bunch of stuff about how the Greeks were influenced and by Indian thought. Ancient Greeks, especially in the matter of reincarnation, which famously Pythagoras believed in it, and others also. Vegetarianism, Socrates, Plato. Of course, vegetarianism isn't an Indian phenomenon exactly. Now, here's a statement sent on by Vishnujan. Modern attitudes have greatly changed about India since colonial times. I'm not so sure about that. Look at the BBC, look at the New York Times. There's an inherent bias. Look at the New York Times, look at the Times of India. Look at the Hindu newspaper. It's all in the book. I'm saying it again. It's a thick tome. Breaking India by Rajiv Malhotra, in which he shows that promising English language journalism students are taken off to America to be taught there to spew all the anti-Indian stuff that comes in the English language press up to the present day. That's it in brief. I don't think modern attitudes have greatly changed. It's maybe in less directly abusive language. Will Durant. He was an American who was traveling around the world to write a history of the world. And when he came to India and he saw what was going on under the British rule, he stopped his life's work for, I think, 2 years, studied the situation, and wrote a book about how the British were advertising themselves as the great benefactors of India, but what they were doing was abominable. So Will Durant wrote, and he didn't have any agenda. He wasn't a Hindu. He was a scholar, but he wrote, India was the motherland of our race and Sanskrit the mother of Europe's languages. She was the mother of our philosophy, mother through the Arabs of much of our mathematics, mother through the Buddha of the ideals embodied in Christianity, mother through the village community of self-government and democracy. Mother India is in many ways the mother of us all. That thing about through the Buddha of the ideals embodied in Christianity, that's very interesting because that could be elaborated more. And there are others who have elaborated. But when Jesus was in India, as it's presumed he was, otherwise there are, 18 years of his life missing in the New Testament. I don't know what the Orthodox Christian explanation for that is, but they're 12 years, from the age 12 to 30, there's just... What happened? He became a Buddhist, vanished into the void. Not exactly. It's said that he was in India. At that time, the influence of Buddhism was very strong. So all these ideals of turn the other cheek. What would you do? What should you do if someone slaps you on the cheek? Turn the other cheek. So Will Durant, among others, believes that much of what Christ picked up, much of what Christ taught was coming through the Buddha. Anyway, he definitely taught a theism, which was not exactly Buddhism. Anyway, it's a complex subject. Dr. Arnold Toynbee, a quote from Dr. Arnold Toynbee, who was at the time a very influential professor of history. He also met Srila Prabhupada and spoke with Srila Prabhupada. So he wrote, it is already becoming clear that a chapter which had a Western beginning will have an Indian ending if it is not to end in the self-destruction of the human race. At this supremely dangerous moment in history, the only way of salvation for mankind is the Indian way. So that must have been written in the 1960s or 1970s. And I myself, growing up in that time period in the West, remember we were talking about the most dangerous moment in history. It was very much present in the consciousness of people that we are liable to be vaporized by nuclear weapons from Russia. Sorry, the Soviet Union. From the Soviet Union. At any moment. It could happen at any time. That fear was there. And became very intense, so I'm told, in the 1980s, where in Britain, where people were sure there was just a matter of time, whether it's days or weeks or months, but not very long before we're all destroyed by nuclear war. But I don't know. I wasn't in the West in the 1980s. So that consciousness was there. And guess what? The world hasn't become free of nuclear weapons. Rather, there are more nuclear weapons and more sophisticated means of delivering them. And there are other kinds of, all kinds of weapons coming up, whether biological weapons and neurological weapons. That to me is the most frightening of all, neurological. Take over your brain. But somehow we don't feel that fear. Just, it's all created by the press, by the mass media. How the masses of people think and respond and react, and it's amazing. Even the so-called big intellectuals, they don't realize how much they are influenced by external influences. So you may say, well, I am too. Yes, but I have chosen to be influenced by a person who I see is perfect in his behavior and his knowledge, because he is perfectly linked to the source of all perfect knowledge, the Vedic knowledge. By his behavior, I see he's a perfect representative of the Supreme Godhead. So I chose that. They say you should make your own choice. Well, I made my choice, or rather, the mercy descended upon me. Okay, others. Well, Carl Sagan, he was a famous astronomer. Not anymore. He's dead. Carl Sagan is dead, folks. Okay, well, it happens to all. He wasn't really an advocate of Vedic knowledge, but he did note that the kind of numerology found in Vedic cosmology and the distances, it corresponds closely with that of what is found in modern astronomy. And he says, no doubt by chance. So he wasn't really a great advocate of Vedic knowledge, but his name is mentioned here. And Karl Oppenheimer, nuclear bomb, great student of Bhagavad Gita. Schrödinger, if you happen to know anything about cats in boxes and things like that, cats in boxes and quantum paradoxes. Apparently, no, not Karl Oppenheimer. He says, access to the Vedas is the greatest privilege this century may claim over all previous centuries. And this is a man who is in the vanguard of nuclear research. Most of my ideas and theories are heavily influenced by Vedanta, says Schrödinger. And I also mentioned previously Heisenberg, another big name in the... Heisenberg was another big, huge name in quantum theory development. Anyway, then going back in time, Domingo Pace, how do you pronounce that? That's still a name in India. It's a Portuguese name. So he's given a description of his visit to Vijayanagara, the famous kingdom of Krishna Deva Rai. So what he wrote at that time, this is going back to the 1520s, Portuguese visitor, as represented in the year 2011 by an author called Deva Kie, I don't know how I pronounce that. So, Domingo Pais, or however that's pronounced, he refrained from guessing at its population of Vijayanagara. That's now Hampi, the remnants are there in Karnataka. He refrained from guessing at its population, lest the improbable figure be taken to impugn the rest of his account, but from a check on its markets he was convinced that it was the best provided city in the world. The kingdom's resources, about which Pace was less reticent, the king has continually 1 million fighting troops under arms. That means a regular army, not a reserve army. A regular army, that means daily training and, The king is of medium height. This is going about Krishnadeva Rai. He was a Vaishnava, by the way. Of fair complexion and good figure, more fat than thin. He has on his face signs of smallpox. He is the most feared and perfect king that possibly could be. Feared for a king, that's considered good in the sense that people follow his authority and criminals are afraid of him and rival kings don't, they're afraid to make forays over his border and so on. The king, further described, cheerful of disposition and very merry. Cheerful of disposition and very merry. He honors foreigners, receives them kindly, asks about their affairs, whatever their condition may be. He's a great ruler and a man of much justice, subject to sudden fits of rage. His title, the King of Kings, the Lord of the Greater Lords of India, Lord of the Three Seas and of the Land. That means that he's a bigger king than the sub-kings underneath him. He is a greater lord than any by reason of what he possesses, that one's things, but it seems that he has nothing compared to what a man like him ought to have, so gallant and perfect is he in all things. He lavishly performed royal rituals. He gave great patronage to academia, art, architecture, architectural extravaganzas. He was hailed as another King Bhoj for his support of scholars, King Bhoj in what is now called Bhopal. He was himself a great scholar and sponsored scholarship. The city itself, Vijayanagara, covered 30 square kilometers. And it occasioned the sort of superlatives which 100 years later would be showered on the Mughal capitals of Agra and Delhi. Gopurams and temples, temple gates up to 240 feet high. 1,000 years before the Gupta dynasty describes that while he, Skandagupta, a king 1,000 years, so we're going back to about the 6th century AD, while he, the king, Skandagupta, is reigning, no man among his subjects falls away from dharma. There is no one distressed in poverty and misery, avaricious, who, being worthy of punishment, is overmuch put to punishment or torture. That might be expected from one of his subjects, but even foreigners, they gave such, or outside people gave a report that the people are well off, there's no poll tax, minimal official restrictions, the king's govern without corporal punishment. Criminals are fined according to circumstance, lightly or heavily. Even in cases of repeated rebellion or crime, they may cut off the right hand in repeated theft. But there's no capital punishment, they say. The king's personal attendants have fixed salaries. People throughout the kingdom, people kill no animals or living beings, nor do they drink wine, nor do they eat garlic or onions. Only the chandalas, modern Indians, take note. Then, famously, there was a Buddhist pilgrim from China, whose name is variously written and pronounced, Fa Xian, He was in India approximately AD 400, and he described Chandragupta II's realm as a utopia. He came by a very difficult route. He came into India. He came looking for Buddhist scriptures. He was a Buddhist monk, and he came looking for original Buddhist scriptures in India. He traveled the length of the Ganga in perfect safety, visiting all the places associated with the Buddha's life. Because if you take the description of the Buddha having been born in Lumpini in Nepal, which some people say is correct, then you have the whole Ganga, because you have to come down to Sarnath near Varanasi, and then just a little way from the Ganga is Gaya. So that Kika Teshu Bhavishyati, that suggests it's, anyway, so many things, suggest it's Nepal. And could be, or it could be interpreted to mean present Bihar. Anyway, these are matters of historical maybes. Anyway, one important thing, and it's said about this Chinese monk, that caste distinctions didn't bother him. And the Europeans who came, it didn't bother them also, because they were used to, in Europe, a similar thing. There are different statuses of people. There are aristocrats, there are merchants, and there are the general people. Aristocrats, merchants, and then there are the priests, and then there are general people. So they're used to, they just took it for granted there's a hierarchical society. They didn't go, oh no, it's so bad, the caste system and this and that. Varna and Jati was going on, but there was no complaining. There was no CPIM at the time. There was no JNU at the time to complain. Why this, why that? People, because the king, his duty was to see that everyone was working and everyone was provided for. So it was not exactly communism, but it was able to deliver what communism wanted to deliver. Because it was a rule of dharma, there was no exploitation. That's the point. So anyway, there's a whole description of the Vedic society, how in the different jatis they had their guilds, or the leaders would come together, everyone would have a voice, they'd discuss around themselves. The different jatis were self-governing to a large extent. A lot of governments wasn't needed, because with the Jajmani system, which was going on in India until recently, everything was fixed. Everyone knew what they had to do. Everyone knew their responsibilities and their rights and what they had. And it was all fixed, and it worked, more or less, to a large extent, without any need of formal law courts or police. And to a large extent, it wasn't needed. Police may have been there for catching criminals and this and that, but to a large extent, it wasn't needed. And even now, at the present time, I'm living in a village in Tamil Nadu at the present time, and the people all know each other, and you don't see police. They don't come here at all. They're no need. And there's some discussion of how the taxes imposed by Muslims on Hindus put a great economic strain, which caused caste distinctions to be exacerbated, and it's a complex history. You may say then, well, why was Krishnadeva Rai defeated in battle by the invading Muslims from the north? Well, one major reason was because two whole divisions of his army were under Muslim leaders, and they were Muslims, and he had personally cared for them, overseen them, trained them, everything. He trusted them fully. And then when the Muslims invaded from the north, they turned around and went to the Muslim side. They were traitors. They didn't have that gratefulness to him. Anyway, we could go on and on and on. And there have been books written about this. There will be more books written about this. Let the truth come out as far as possible about all these things. At least the massive propagation of non-truth should be countered. But the real thing is, who are we? What are we doing in this world? Why are we in this place? We're in this land of untruth. We're forgetting Krishna. This is the real thing. The great treasure of India, the greatest treasure of all, more than social system, the gems, such as the Kohinoor jewel stolen, or they say it was traded or given as a gift, but anyway, it's not in India, it's in Britain. Kohinoor, it's a Muslim term. So, more than that, the real treasure is the spiritual knowledge of India, which culminates in knowing Krishna. Vedaischa sarvaham eva vedyaha. In all the Vedas, Krishna says, I am the object of knowledge, so let this be propagated. Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We all have an intimate, loving relationship with him. But forgetting that, we enter into enmity with others and we become enemies of the truth, even the truth of this world, of the nature of this world, what to speak of the spiritual truth of our relationship with Krishna. So let this knowledge be propagated. I request those who want to know about this as it is, properly, without being cheated by so many cheaters in the name of Hinduism, please read the books of His Divine Grace Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. They will help you immensely, immensely, if you are sincere to know the actual truth of who you are, who we all are, who is God, what is this world, what is the spiritual world. Tremendous knowledge, the best knowledge you can get in those books. Hare Krishna. Vancha kalpa tarubhyascha kripa sindhubhyavacha patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namaha. Dante nithaya chunakang padayani patya kritvacha kakushatameta dahambravimi. He sadhava sakala eva vihaya durat gauranga chandra charane kuruta. Parivadatu jano yata tata va nanu mukarona vayang vichara yamaha. Hari rasa madira madati matta bhuvi vilutama nartama nirvishama. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Rama Hare Hare.